Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel. Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Friday, the 7th of April, these are our main stories. Israel has blamed the Palestinian group Hamas for the intense rocket bombardment from across the Lebanese border. The Israeli military then carried out retaliatory attacks on Gaza. A White House report says little more could have been done to prevent the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, but that evacuations should have started earlier. And French riot police have again clashed with protesters opposed to the government's pension reforms. Also in this podcast...
What's going on? Turn round! Chewbacca, I can't see!
The man who designed iconic sets for movies such as Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, Norman Reynolds, has died aged 89. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Thursday evening after a security cabinet meeting that Israel's enemies would pay a price for aggression after a major rocket attack from southern Lebanon.
I made it very clear that our enemy shouldn't test us. We're calling to restore calm, and we will act against the extremists that resort to violence. And as for the aggression against us from a different front, we will hit our enemy, and they will pay a price for every act of aggression.
And a short time after Benjamin Netanyahu gave that television address, Israel replied to the more than 30 rockets that had been fired from Lebanon. In a statement released late on Thursday night, the Israeli army said that it was currently striking in the Gaza Strip. Reports from the ground, as we record this podcast, spoke of three explosions. A Palestinian security source said the strikes hit several Hamas training sites. Israel had earlier blamed the Palestinian militant group Hamas for the rockets fired from Lebanon, but it had denied having anything to do with the attacks. Before the latest operation by the Israeli army, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had urged all sides to avoid escalation. Stefan Dujarric is his spokesman.
We condemn the multiple rockets being fired from Lebanon into northern Israel today. We urge all actors to exercise maximum restraint. The UN interim force in Lebanon remains in contact with authorities on both sides of the blue line, and we urge the parties to liaise with our peacekeepers and avoid any unilateral action that could further escalate the situation.
Tensions were already high after Israeli police stormed Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque this week. Our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, Yoland Nell, closely followed the events as they happened during the day and gave this assessment of Mr. Netanyahu's televised speech just before Israel launched its strikes on Gaza.
Benjamin Netanyahu said that his government would hit its enemies, that they would pay a price for all acts of aggression, as he put it. And he talked too about how there were internal divisions in the country, but that would not stop what he called a strong security response. The country would be united in a time of crisis, he said. And we do know that leading opposition figures in Israel have backed the government's security response, whatever it might be. He also talked about the situation in Jerusalem. Mr. Netanyahu said there was no interest interest in Israel in changing the decades-old status quo rules that operate at the contested holy site at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, known to Jews as Temple Mount. Mr. Netanyahu said, we will act aggressively against extremists who resort to violence there. When it comes to what's happened, Israel has to show a strong response. I mean, if you look at this in perspective, there are some reports that this was the largest barrage of rockets fired at Israel from Lebanon since 2006, since the Second Lebanon War. This is something that is unusual, but at the same time, a response from Israel has to be carefully calibrated. It's blaming Palestinian factions, not specifically the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, backed by Iran, for this rocket fire from Lebanon. But it's also said it assumes that Hezbollah knew what was going on, and that means that, you know, there is a real risk of a provocation with Hezbollah, and that is an entity which has a huge arsenal of weapons.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem. Iran and Saudi Arabia have been bitter rivals in the Gulf for many years, almost going to war on a few occasions. But remarkably, they appear to have come to something of a diplomatic truce, brokered by China, no less. Now, these two Middle Eastern countries have agreed to restore ties and even reopen diplomatic missions after their respective foreign ministers met in Beijing, their first such meeting in 7 years. I spoke to Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, and began by asking him how he would describe the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely awful, would be to put it mildly. The two have been implacable Middle East rivals. And people, I think, tend to oversimplify this, saying, well, Saudi Arabia is ruled by Sunnis and Iran is ruled by Shias. It's much more complicated than the religious split, the two different big divisions in Islam. It's really about geography. And Iran, under the Shah, was the most powerful country in the Gulf region. And then, of course, it suffered years of isolation. Saudi Arabia enlarged its strategic pact with the United States and has tried to keep in check Iran's recent growth across the region. And Saudi Arabia has been hugely worried by things like the war in Yemen, where Iranian-backed Houthi rebels seized power over 8 years ago. But that war has failed to result in any kind of a victory for anybody. And Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, has looked over its shoulder and seen that, in its view, the United States is disengaging from the region. President Obama talked about a pivot to the Pacific. There was President Obama reaching out to Iran. And the Saudis have basically concluded that they are going to have to live with Iran, and they're better off making a deal with them because they don't feel they can rely on the United States anymore.
It's quite amazing that they are reopening their embassies and diplomatic ties within weeks of brokering a kind of deal that China had a huge hand in.
Yeah, it's a diplomatic triumph for China. There's no question about it. I mean, it's not a natural ally for Saudi, but it is now because it's a customer for Saudi oil and energy. And when it comes to personal relationships, there's really not much good blood between Washington and Riyadh. And Riyadh is reaching out not only to China, but to other nations, including Russia. So it's loosening its strategic alliance to the United States. It's not broken, but it's loosening.
Yeah, and it does help, of course, that China will never bully or pressurize Saudi or Iran or Russia, for that matter, about human rights.
Yeah, you're right there. I mean, all the Gulf nations say that they are fed up with being lectured over this, and there's a lot of talk of hypocrisy. One of the things that I find extraordinary as somebody who's watched and lived in the Middle East for so long is that the Gulf Arab states, and indeed ISIS and Al-Qaeda, are largely silent on China's treatment of the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. You know, there's documentary evidence that points to around 1 million of them being incarcerated in these compulsory re-education camps. And yet there's not a squeak about that, or very little. So yes, I think there's an element of realpolitik here. China is a massively important trading partner for every Gulf nation, but particularly the Saudis. And that, I think, kind of trumps a lot of other things.
Frank Gardner. When the US withdrew its troops from Afghanistan in 2021, there were scenes of chaos in Kabul airport as huge numbers of Afghans tried to flee the incoming Taliban government. Since then, the Taliban have imposed their hardline policies on the country, notably banning girls and women from secondary schools and universities. But now the Biden administration has released a provisional report reviewing the US withdrawal And its conclusion is that little more could have been done to prevent the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Speaking at a White House briefing, the National Security spokesman John Kirby defended the decision to leave and blamed the chaos on Donald Trump.
Decisions made and the lack of planning done by the previous administration significantly limited options available. President Biden inherited a forced presence in Afghanistan of some 2,500 troops. He inherited a special immigrant visa program that had been starved of resources. And he inherited a deal struck between the previous administration and the Taliban that called for the complete removal of all U.S. troops by May of 2021, or else the Taliban would go back to war against the United States.
I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Jessica Parker, and began by asking her for more detail about this partially released document by the Biden administration.
Reading it and then listening as well to John Kirby earlier, there is, I'd say, a point that they want to make, which is, I think, a political one, that they think it was the right thing still to do to withdraw from Afghanistan. They say the conflict had drifted into nation building, which had never meant to be. But it then goes on to actually blame Donald Trump, the previous administration, for some of the things that he had done in the lead up to all this and the situation that Joe Biden's team are essentially saying that they inherited. So the deal that the US had reached with the Taliban, the Doha agreement, and then the lack of planning they claim that had been done subsequent to that by the Trump administration, the low number of troops that had been left in Afghanistan, a failure as well to properly resource a visa program for Afghans who had worked with US forces and US personnel. So there is quite an effort in this report and by Mr. Kirby to say that Joe Biden had inherited a difficult situation from the previous administration. So I think it has to be taken as a kind of political piece of work as much as something that's looking at maybe what went wrong on that chaotic withdrawal, which many people remember seeing those desperate scenes from Kabul airport.
Absolutely. And human beings clinging to giant transport planes as it took off from the airport. There was an admission of intelligence failures, though, Jess.
Yeah, I mean, certainly watching the briefing, a sort of tacit admission of intelligence failings. And we've known that what happened and the speed with which the Taliban took over the country shocked the Western world. So to some extent, I don't think it's news that there were some intelligence failings. But within this report, it says the intelligence community's assessment in early 21 was that Taliban advances would accelerate across large portions of Afghanistan after a complete US military withdrawal and potentially lead to the Taliban capturing Kabul within a year or two. Of course, it happened far faster than that. So Mr. Kirby, John Kirby, was kind of pressed on these points and also pressed by journalists who were quite combative in some of the questions they were asking him about whether there were any regrets about the way that the whole thing had been handled. And Mr. Kirby simply replied that the president had been proud of everyone who'd been involved in the operation and that no operation ever goes perfectly to plan. And he also argued that ending a war is never easy or low risk. But I think certainly an effort in this report and the presentation of the report to defend what had happened whilst insisting that this was all about trying to learn lessons for the future.
Jessica Parker. As we heard in the earlier podcast, China has been hosting the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. Mr. Macron, who is in Beijing for a state visit, told President Xi that he's counting on him to bring Russia to its senses over Ukraine. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The red carpet was out when Emmanuel Macron arrived at Beijing's Great Hall, the start of an important complex mission overshadowed by a war half a world away in Europe. Monsieur Macron made it clear he wanted President Xi to do something about it.
Russian aggression in Ukraine has dealt a blow to this international stability. It has put an end to decades of peace in Europe, and I know I can count on you under the two principles I've just mentioned, to bring Russia to its senses and everyone back to the negotiating table.
For now, that remains a distant prospect. Beijing has presented its own 12-point peace plan, but it's thin on detail and viewed with suspicion in the West. President Xi said China wanted to see a settlement, but beyond repeating Beijing's insistence that nuclear weapons should not be used, he gave no sign of any willingness to put pressure on Vladimir Putin. No such sign was expected, but the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, did say that President Xi had told her that he was willing to meet Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, when the conditions and time were right. For all the tensions surrounding China's relations with the West, over Ukraine, human rights and the future of Taiwan, Emmanuel Macron says Europe must resist the urge to reduce trade and diplomatic ties. He's being accompanied by a large business delegation, and today deals were struck on green and nuclear energy, as well as a new Airbus assembly line in China.
Paul Adams, and as President Macron takes part in diplomatic talks in Beijing, the disruptions in France continue. Once again, there have been mass protests against his plans to change the pension age from 62 to 64, which was pushed through Parliament last month without a vote. France's Constitutional Council will decide on its validity next week. Hugh Schofield spent Thursday on the noisy streets of Paris.
Another big demonstration on this 11th day of action. First one was back in mid-January. It's pretty much the same scene, a big, big crowd. I can't tell you whether it's more than the last one or not. And then with these outbreaks of violence, which we saw right here behind us, there's a restaurant just over there called La Rotonde, which is famous for the protesters because President Macron went there on the night of his first election and it's become a bit of a target for them. So there was a lot of argy-bargy, shall we say, with stones and bottles being thrown at the police who were protecting the restaurant. Briefly, the canopy of the restaurant was set on fire, but it was put out. But they keep on going. They're another big, big display of force from those who oppose the pension reform. But the fact is, the pension reform has now gone through Parliament. It's only got one more hurdle, really, constitutionally, and that's this Constitutional Council, which has to rule on whether it's in conformity with the Constitution. And if it passes that, then it will be law. I think it's pretty unlikely that they will decide that the whole thing is against the Constitution, but one can't rule it out. Don't forget that this is not a court. These are wise men and women, all of them mainly ex-politicians. So they may give a political slant to their interpretation of the Constitution, and it may be they give some kind of negative spin to the law, which allows both sides to climb down without a loss of face. But I have to say, I think that's quite unlikely. I think Macron now is determined to see this through. He thinks he's taken all the damage he's going to get, so what's there to lose from continuing?
Hugh Schofield in a noisy Paris. Still to come.
Some of the paragraphs were accurate, and then there were other paragraphs that described things that were completely incorrect.
A politician in Australia may sue the makers of the AI chatbot ChatGPT after it implied that he was guilty of bribery. And we'll be back right after this.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season two.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
Welcome back. And here in London, Buckingham Palace says that it is cooperating with an independent study into links between the British monarchy and the slave trade in the 17th and 18th centuries. It's part of a trend among various institutions, including the Bank of England and the Guardian newspaper, to look at their connections to slavery. The palace is granting access to its personal archives to Manchester University in Northern England. King Charles has said that he takes the issues profoundly seriously. Arlie Gill, chairman of Grenada's Reparation Committee, spoke of the action he wanted the royal family to take.
The King and the Prince of Wales speaking of being profoundly sorrowful for the involvement with regards to slave trade and slavery. We would want and demand that that profound sorrow be converted into an apology of acceptance that what they have done is a crime against humanity, and they should make some repair with regards to the harm that was caused.
Trevor Bernard, director of the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation in Hull, said the move by the royal family was welcome, but overdue.
It's hard to think of any family in this country that is more directly involved in slavery than the royal family. Charles II set up the Royal African Company. The Royal African Company transported more enslaved Africans to the Americas than any other institution in history.
Our royal correspondent Sarah Campbell gave me the details of the research project.
The Historic Royal Palaces, that's a charity that looks after royal buildings, has now become a partner in a research project being carried out by a researcher at the University of Manchester. And she is looking at, among other things, the links between British monarchy and the transatlantic slave trade during the 17th and 18th century. And the royal household is supporting that research by allowing access to the royal collection and the royal archives. And the project started in October 2022, so that's just a month after King Charles acceded the throne.
A lot of people will be asking, why comment now? But I think you've kind of alluded to it. Maybe he wants to get something in train before his coronation.
I think across the globe, this issue of slavery and reparations and should something be done about it has become much more of a significant issue than perhaps it was even sort of 2 or 3 years ago. And it's something that the King and Prince William on a tour last year to the Caribbean were sort of directly criticised and came face to face with. And I think both want to have a greater understanding of their family's role in this. So to give you some of the statements that we've heard about King Charles talking about it before, this was last year when he was Prince Charles, told Commonwealth leaders that to unlock the power of our common future, we must also acknowledge the wrongs that have shaped our past. He's talked of his profound sorrow at the suffering of so many. And those two words are ones that his son, Prince William, used when he was in the Caribbean, talking of his profound sorrow and the appalling atrocity of slavery. Of course, what you haven't heard there is sorry. You've heard sorrow, not sorry. And I think that is quite an important distinction. Campaigners are calling for a direct apology. So they haven't gone that far yet. I have to say that the statement that came from Buckingham Palace was in direct response to an article in the Guardian newspaper. And they have broken down links between the monarchy and the slave trade. So they're reporting today that back to 1564, Elizabeth I, according to the paper, first gave a large royal ship to the slave trader John Hawkins in exchange for a share in profits. And something else that's recently come to light, a previously unseen document showing that in 1689 there was a transfer of £1,000 worth of shares in the slave trading company, the Royal African Company, infamous in the transatlantic slave trade, and these shares were given to King William III. So evidence, you would say, there potentially of direct profiteering by the monarchy from the slave trade.
And does that open the royal family then, or even the British state, to some sort of restorative justice or even reparations, especially to Caribbean nations?
Well, that's the question, and that's what many people, particularly in the Caribbean nations, are calling for. And I think this is we'll have to wait and see.
Sarah Campbell. President Biden will visit Northern Ireland next week as part of the events marking the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. That was the political deal which largely ended 3 decades of conflict known as the Troubles. One key component was the decision to bring Sinn Féin, the party with close ties to the Irish Republican paramilitaries of the IRA, into a power-sharing regional government. The BBC's Ireland correspondent Chris Page was in his last year at school at the time, and he's been back to the classroom to hear some personal reflections on the agreement and its impact.
Do you remember this room here?
Oh, yeah, room A. I see it's room E now, but
yeah.
This is where it all happened.
Well, I'm back in our history and politics classroom with our teacher, David Armstrong, and a few old friends. Victoria, new school magazine report there. You wrote it. Mr. Armstrong's kindly looked it out for us. Do you want to read a bit from it?
The year of 1997-98 was a year of expectancy and tension in Northern Ireland politics, with parties working round the clock to try and reach an agreement by the May deadline. The current affairs team consisted of chairpersons Simon McAvoy, committee members Gail McConnell, and Secretary Victoria Dunoon.
What do you remember most about that time?
There was still this amazing optimism of everyone here that, yes, this can happen and we're not going to give up hope.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder.
And today is about the promise of a bright future. A line can be drawn under the bloody past.
Mr. Armstrong, what were your thoughts sitting at the front of this classroom and others and looking out at us?
In terms of teaching it, I sort of felt there's something happening here. It's not just history, this is now. At that stage, It was actually whether you were going to buy in for hope that change would come, or we're just going to see more of the same.
Gail, what do you think back and remember?
It felt like such an exciting time because what we were studying in the classroom wasn't in the textbooks, and we were all about to turn 18. We were also being schooled by you that, you know, voting is just like the bare minimum of what political involvement and activism looks like. It really felt like an experience of kind of coming of age.
Simon, you've lived in England for, I think, nearly a whole 25 years.
What really comes to me is how alive politics felt at that period. You know, I'd always been interested in politics, but really it had always felt like a kind of a distant thing that other people do. And suddenly we were kind of in the middle of this really momentous political moment. It felt like we were kind of sorting it out for ourselves.
Gil, you have written a couple of volumes of poetry, one of which focuses on very personal experiences in your life that you did speak about.
My own kind of personal history was that my father was a prison governor in the Mays prison, and he was shot and killed by the IRA outside our home in 1984 when I was 3.5. I really wanted to try to understand the very long history that had kind of created the context for my father's murder and for everything that followed.
I remember you, when the Sinn Féin came, you were sitting right up the front and listening to them very intently. And people still tend to sit at the front at those meetings, which is why you, in a way, stood out. But I also was aware of your story in that sense.
I'll read something from this that kind of speaks to the moment of my father's murder, I suppose, but also that tries to reckon with an aftermath. And it's sort of an aftermath that's endless, really. My father rejoices. That's what it means. My name, I mean. But did he? What, if anything, was the source of his joy? Was there joy between us before he left, or after he walks through the hall, the squeaky door saddle, across the tiles, walking outside into the morning, into those bullets sailing through the blue air, into perforation, into a heap, into gravel, an almost human shape, into death, into silence, or whatever comes after.
What are your thoughts on the Good Friday Agreement, sort of then and now?
I would have voted in favour of it. One of my father's murderers did get out of prison under the Good Friday Agreement. One of the things I'm conscious the Good Friday Agreement didn't do was give us a way collectively to reckon with the past.
Gail McConnell, ending that report by Chris Page in Northern Ireland. A mayor in Australia says he may sue the company behind the artificial intelligence writing tool ChatGPT after it falsely claimed that he had served time in prison for bribery. The web app incorrectly identified Brian Hood as the guilty party in a corruption scandal, which he had in fact exposed. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Brian Hood was the whistleblower in a corruption scandal involving a company owned by the Reserve Bank of Australia. Several people were charged. Mr. Hood was very much not one of them. But that fact didn't stop an article generated by ChatGPT, an automated writing service powered by artificial intelligence. Instead, it cast him as the villain, who was jailed for his part in a conspiracy to bribe foreign officials to win currency printing contracts. He only found out after friends told him about it. He explained to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that he then saw the story for himself.
After making the inquiry, it generated 5 or 6 paragraphs of information. The really disturbing thing was that some of the paragraphs were accurate. They contained accurate information about names, dates, times, places. And then there were other paragraphs that described things that were completely incorrect. It told me that I'd been charged with very serious criminal offences, that I'd been convicted of them, and that I'd spent 30 months in jail.
Mr. Hood says that if OpenAI, which owns the chatbot, doesn't correct the false claims, he'll sue. It would be the first defamation lawsuit against the automated service. However, a new version of ChatGPT apparently avoids the mistakes of its predecessor. It correctly explains that Mr. Hood was a whistleblower who was praised for his actions. But his lawyers say that defamatory material that damages the mayor's reputation still exists, and their efforts to have the mistakes rectified will continue.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. The British production designer and art director Norman Reynolds has died at the age of 89. The two-time Oscar winner was known for creating vivid cinematic worlds, including the iconic carbon freezing chamber, which entombs Han Solo in Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back, and the rolling boulder in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Our reporter, Steve Nibbs, reflects on his life and work.
It is one of the most recognisable scenes in movie history. Indiana Jones fleeing a huge boulder bearing down on him inside an ancient temple at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark. The man responsible for that set was Norman Reynolds. In 2016, 35 years after Raiders came out, I interviewed him, along with the film producer Robert Watts. They explained showing the set to Steven Spielberg, the film's director.
I said to Steven, I'll just show you how this boulder works, because I wasn't sure whether he'd like it or not. So he rolled the ball down, and we all stood back, watched the ball roll down, and there was a small figure at the end of the track, who was Robert Watts.
Stephen asked me to run in front of it, and Stephen says, OK, and I said to you after that, I said, you could have stopped it, couldn't you, Norman? You said no.
Where do you think you're going? Well, I'm not going that way.
Norman won an Oscar for his work on Raiders. Before that, he'd also grab one for his role as art director on the original Star Wars film, A New Hope. Norman went on to design the Star Wars sequels, as well as a string of other films such as Superman, Empire of the Sun, Alien 3, and the first of the Mission Impossible films starring Tom Cruise. Kathy Kennedy, the Lucasfilm president, said today that Norman set the standard with the look of Star Wars and Indiana Jones, inspiring generations of film designers. Steven Spielberg told the BBC there was nothing that Norman couldn't make work, that he was a joyful, friendly and massive talent.
Steve Nibbs on the life of the British production designer and art director Norman Reynolds, who has died at the age of 89. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I am Joe Lynham. And until next time, goodbye.
Where does North Korea get the cash to fund its nuclear weapons program?
North Korea is nothing if it is not creative, clever, agile.
Well, according to U.S. investigators, cybercrime.
A cyber attack was on no one's radar.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
Although the regime denies any involvement, evidence suggests that North Korea's hackers are getting better and better at doing it.
What they did was also quite sophisticated, not something anybody has seen before.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
I was put in handcuffs, both my feet bound and my hands, taken to an interrogation centre. We were genuinely very frightened.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.